Session number 6042, Reel 2.
Mr. Adams, Reel 2.
As I was riding my motorbike, which the Australians had given us, on the way to Hill 85 to do a rendezvous with the then occupants, there were one or two trucks on this road, and out of the blue, a Japanese fighter came down the road at quite low level and obviously decided he'd like to shoot up what was on the road. In record time, once I heard the machine guns of the plane firing, in record time I drove off the road into a rubber plantation and waited till he'd expended his energy. And then I returned to the road and got to Hill 85. I suppose that was the nearest miss, personally, I had, except for the fact that whilst I was at RESC headquarters, the area came under shell fire, and what was obviously a 75 or 76 millimetre shell came into the room that we were eating in. We were eating some bully beef and biscuits, and fortunately failed to explode. It just made a lot of dust as it had come through the wall, but it didn't explode. But then I went to help over the road, which was a Corps of Signals headquarters, because some shells had hit them and they'd had a few casualties. And because we'd got nothing to do, we went and assisted them. And asking if I could be found anything to do, because there's nothing worse than having nothing to do when you're under bombing or shell fire or anything else. And I asked if I could man the twin Bren on its anti-aircraft mounting behind the house. But there'd been a ban on firing it against these low-flying Japanese aeroplanes because they said it would give our position away. And I didn't think much of that outlook on life, because if you carry it on forever, you'll never fire anything in case you give your position away. And another RESC captain made quite a fuss about this ban on firing these guns, because it should be realised that by this time there were no Royal Air Force planes left in Singapore. And in fact, the only RAF plane I saw in those last few days was a light plane, a biplane, which I think was a Tiger Moth, which was trying to do some reconnaissance. And I am subsequently been told it was manned by the Volunteer Reserve of the Royal Air Force Malaya. And then I was warned to stand by to become Divisional Ammunition Officer, because Bill Cowell, who was the Divisional Ammunition Officer, that's an RESC job. His job is to get ammunition to all the units of the division and know where it can be found. He had been ordered to go on the 13th of February evacuation party, official evacuation party. As it turned out, there was no ship, and he returned to the headquarters, and I did not become Divisional Ammunition Officer, although he had given me a brief on where the ammunition was to be found. And there appeared to be only two dumps available then, and there was a great shortage of certain types of ammunition, such as 40mm Bofors. In order to get rid of me, because I was moaning about doing nothing, I was sent down to the polo ground, which had become a large supply depot. But when I got there, there was again nothing to do for me. And I was just hanging about. Not on the day of surrender, I was standing on the little road leading to it, trying to find myself something to do, showing trucks coming for rations, where to go to, and a man pulled up. In fact, his name, I remember it very vividly, his name was Trooper Carroll, and he was in 155 Field Regiment, Royal Artillery, who had been the Lanarkshire Yeomanry. And a shell came over just as he was getting out of his 1500 weight to come to me, and he was killed outright. And I went and reported it to the captain in charge of the supply depot, and he said, well, just bury him. And I got a little group, dug a grave for him there and then. on the edge of the polo ground and read the service in the back of a soldier's paybook over his grave, took his identity tag, you know there's two tags and you cut one off to report death, emptied his pocket of papers, and he hadn't got a rifle. His rifle was in the truck, which had also been somewhat damaged by this shell. And then I put them in my pocket. And when I'd been a prisoner a couple of weeks, the call came for any officer who'd got these sort of things to hand them in. And I handed them in to his regiment. And ultimately his padre came to see me. At least that unit's padre. And criticised me because I hadn't given him a Roman Catholic burial service. Because he was a Catholic, in fact, Trooper Cattle. And I said, well, I'd... in sort of circumstances in which he'd had the standard army burial service read over his grave. And quite frankly, I wasn't very keen on sticking around in the open in case some more came over. Telescoping the time, the word came round that there was to be an armistice at 8:30 that night. There's always a lot of confusion about the time because the Japanese tended to stick to Tokyo time, but I remember being told that there would be an armistice and ceasefire at 8:30 that night. And about an hour before this armistice, quite a lot of metal came whizzing through the air. And it turned out that it was one of the 18th Division artillery regiments who were blowing their guns up. And these nasty pieces of jagged metal. So at that, a lot of us took shelter because the last thing we wanted to have happen was to be killed by a blown-up, deliberately blown-up British gun. I don't know which of our three regiments it was which was in the vicinity. Anyway, the following morning, we returned to RESC headquarters in, I've forgotten the name of the road, and we waited for the Japanese. Of course, we are now at the 16th of February, and the Japanese turned up. We'd had orders, or at least the headquarters, of which I was a very junior member, the most junior member, the most junior second lieutenant, said we were to obey the orders of the Japanese who came in. And these little men came in, waving pistols, revolvers, and ordered us to dump certain things. One or two of them took a fancy to people's wristwatches, but fortunately they had a sergeant with them, a Japanese sergeant, who told them not to steal wristwatches. And we were told where to go to, which was a couple of miles march to a field on the Bukitima, just off the Bukitima Road. And there, during the course of the day, there was a great concentration of prisoners in this field. And I gathered this had happened to many other prisoners. The Japanese picked fields or anywhere, barrack squares, concentrated the prisoners. And on the little hill behind this field, they'd got just a couple of machine guns and machine gunners and sentries at the gate of the field. There was a great shortage of water, of course, because the reservoirs that supplied Singapore with water were in fact supplied from Malaya, not from the island, and the Japanese had conquered the mainland 2 weeks before. So the reservoirs had had no replenishment, and in the Japanese bombing and shelling of Singapore Island, they had damaged so many water mains that water was a trickle even where there was any at all. On that first morning in the field, I became acutely aware that I was rather deficient of kit. In fact, all I had was the shirt and the shorts that I was wearing and the underwear, a steel helmet and a haversack with change of clothing, change of socks and things like that in it, and damn all else. And I became a little perturbed that I was going into a future of unknown duration with no gear. I could see many people with lots of gear, and I remembered that back at the RASC headquarters, where, of course, there'd been masses of kit abandoned when the Japanese came along, that if I could get back there, I could rig myself up with some clothes. So asking a man lying on the grass near me had got a little Red Cross haversack. It wasn't full of Red Cross supplies, it was just a haversack. He picked it up on the road. And I asked him if I could borrow it. And I went up to the guard on the gate, the Japanese guard. And there was a motorbike by the gate too that someone had arrived on, and the Japs had ordered him to leave it there. And with a complete language barrier, I pointed to the Red Cross on this haversack and pointed in the distance, having remembered the way we'd come from the RASC headquarters. And he just signalled me to go. So I got on the motorbike, went back to our headquarters. But in that very short period since we'd left it, the looters had been in. Not so much Japanese looters, but the local inhabitants. But I picked myself out quite a bit of clothing and gear from there, including a blanket. And I also picked up a pack, and I've still got it. And it still has the original owner's name on it, Sergeant Henworthy, whom I don't know, but I've got his pack. I came off the motorbike once because a lot of telegraph lines had come down from shelling and I didn't see them, and I went back a different way and I ploughed into these. But I got back to the field and the same sentry was on duty, and I put the motorbike down at the field and he let me back into the field again. So I'd started off a little richer than I'd been a few hours before, richer in material goods.
What was the attitude towards escape at this time?
Well, bearing in mind that I personally knew that those who'd been told officially to escape on the 13th had failed the ship that was supposed to take them had left with women and with nurses and mostly women aboard. Truthfully, very few people gave a thought to it. Of course, everyone knew, everyone who could read an old school atlas, which is what we'd looked at on board the ship, that we were a very, very long way from any allies. And bear in mind that 18th Division, certainly the two brigades of it, 54th and 55th, knew nothing of the area. They hadn't got a clue of the area. We'd just been pitchforked into this, what turned out to be a lost cause before we got there. Perhaps us getting there made it even more a lost cause. There wasn't a great thought to escape, not from the group I was with, because no one knew where they'd go to.
What was the morale like at this time? Were people depressed at the surrender?
I think depressed is an understatement. Bloody depressed. Some people were very melancholy. And then there were those around who said, just make the best of it. And people would say, oh, the Yanks will come soon, or the Australians will come soon, or someone will come soon.
Were people looking for people to blame?
Well, everyone was blaming someone. Everyone was blaming someone.
Who was it who tended to get the blame?
Well, the normal people who get blamed. And even though we'd been there such a short time, we had discovered what was the nickname for Malaya Command Headquarters. Malaya Command Headquarters was located at Fort Canning, Singapore, which is sort of in the city area. And we'd already been told that no one called it Fort Canning or Malaya Command Headquarters. Everyone called it Confusion Castle, which isn't very... we'd told that before Singapore surrendered. And it isn't very elevating to be told that the headquarters is called Confusion Castle.
Did you feel that that was a fair description?
Only with hindsight, because of my very, very recent arrival in Singapore, because I was a very junior officer, because I lacked information and because I lacked knowledge, I didn't judge at the time. But when we'd been prisoners only a few weeks and we'd had a chance to talk to people in all arms of the service, services, not just service, and hear some of the personal anecdotes of people's experiences. But all this would be second-hand from me because I've said I knew nothing. It appeared there had been a considerable amount of confusion, inefficiency, and to some degree mishandling. Compounded by the fact, of course, that within the first week of the Japanese war starting, the Japanese had seized complete command of the seas. Once they'd sunk the Prince of Wales and Repulse, that was the end of the Royal Navy in that area, the effective use of the Royal Navy in that area. Most of the RAF had very obsolete aeroplanes. For instance, during my captivity, I met several people from wildebeest squadrons. And if you look back deep into the museum's archives, you might find a picture of a Vickers wildebeest. And also its age, because most of the pilots of the wildebeest had very bravely gone to their deaths, shot down by Japanese planes of superior performance. But I personally did not see any, on Singapore Island, whilst I was there, and I was only there for 9 days before we capitulated, I personally, the only plane I saw with RAF markings on was that Tiger Moth doing observation. Of course, it's a historical fact that the British also had no tanks.
Was there any tendency to blame the political authorities in Britain?
At that stage, no. However, with hindsight, it is apparent that the blame should be really attached to the political side of things, because soldiers, airmen or sailors, can't perform unless they've got the wherewithal with which to perform, and that they have the necessary morale to perform. But if you look at the history of Malaya and Singapore for the 5 years before the Japanese invasion, one sees it recorded in cabinet papers and official documents. We cannot afford to send any more stuff to Singapore. We will put defences at Singapore to defend it from a seaward invasion. Guns will be put there to defend it from a seaward invasion, and so on. But then when one reads Churchill's history of the war, you know, the 6-volume history of World War II, you will actually see him set down that he gave instructions and the chief of staff gave instructions and the American chiefs of staff agreed and Roosevelt agreed on the priorities for the conduct of the war. And the top one was to win the Battle of the Atlantic, and then he'd worked on down to help the Russians to win in North Africa, to conquer Europe, and low down on the list was a little remark that Malaya in the war will be required to give us as much tin and rubber as it can. And no new stuff could be spared for the Royal Air Force and the Navy in Singapore. They just had these hodgepodge reinforcements. And as I've already said 20 minutes ago, we were never destined for there. With hindsight, again, I think we'd have been far more use, 18th Division, if we had been sent to Burma, because the Japanese didn't invade Burma till long after they conquered Malaya and Singapore. I think we'd have been an effective force in Burma.
Can we pick up now your personal story about where you left off in Japanese captivity?
Well, from the field where we've been concentrated, either on the first or second day, I'm not very clear on this, we didn't eat very well there, because all we could eat was what we'd brought there. We were told to march to Changi. Of course, none of us in 18th Division knew where Changi was. But Japanese soldiers, you know, private soldiers and corporals with rifles and bayonets were our guides, and they didn't have many of them to guard us. I mean, we could have run anywhere, but where could we have run to? Because we'd noticed, even on our way from headquarters to the field, that overnight every darned house had sprung a Japanese flag, so there wasn't much to turn to in the local population for assistance. And unlike escaping from a camp in Germany, where I, with my blonde hair and blue eyes, could pass for a local, there wasn't much chance of me or anyone like me passing for a dark-skinned, brown-eyed, black-haired Malay or Chinese. Anyway, we set off on this march, carrying all our worldly goods, and finally, after dark, we arrived at an area in Changi, I personally arriving at a place called India Lines, which was an old barracks which had been somewhat damaged in the war, but not a lot. It had some shells and bombs dropped on it, but it was in fair shape. But thousands of people were put into an area that was designed as barracks for hundreds. And some people, in fact, had to make shelters to sleep on grass or whatever. And there we thought we should stew out for the rest of however long the war would be. There were all sorts of rumours. Rations were very, very low. The incidence of sickness was very, very high. And, of course, included in the what I will call hospitals, but they were not hospitals, they were places called hospitals, lacking medical supplies, were the wounded of the campaign in Malaya and Singapore, the British wounded. And in March, let me say that I know I was at Changi on the 17th of February, but I can't remember exactly when or where it fell. But about the middle of March, a very severe dysentery epidemic broke out, probably due to the lack of toilet paper, to the millions of flies, to the lack of latrine facilities, because we had to dig them. Although there were latrines in the barracks, there was no running water, so they were not in use. And like many others, I succumbed to very severe bacillary dysentery. And I was admitted to what was called Roberts Hospital, where there was a large concentration of British doctors from the army working there. And I even remember the wards, as I'll call them, they were really barrack rooms, were already over full when I got there. And you had a bed, a man on the floor, a bed, a man on the floor, a bed, a man on the floor. And you know one of the effects of dysentery is constantly wanting to defecate, and defecating in a rather nasty way. There wasn't room in the room for me, so I went onto the balcony, and as I had no bed or anything to take in with me, I slept on the concrete balcony with a ground sheet and my precious blanket. And the next bed to me, but it was on a bed, was a Colonel Ross, who was in fact a doctor himself. He was one of the leading eye surgeons in the Malaya command area. He had also got dysentery. So I was down there and he was up there, and next to me was another soldier. We weren't segregated particularly by ranks, as normally happens in an army hospital. And there were no toilets. There were just tins at the end that you had to try and get to. And of course, some people didn't make it, so it was the pressure on wanting to go, and so weak were they. And the toilet paper was non-existent, and in fact they issued what is called coir, C-O-I-R, which is the fibre between a coconut and the outer husk of a coconut. That was issued for you for the question of wiping it afterwards. Of course, coir is very, very rough, so everyone got a sore backside as well as having dysentery. Now, there was a high fatality rate from dysentery, and Official records show that in the first year of Robert's hospital, the rate of admissions from the prisoners was just under 900 for every 1,000 prisoners. So there was a very high fatality, sickness rate, and because of the lack of drugs, a very high fatality rate. All the time came that I did recover, various blokes in the unit came to see me, my batman came to see me every day, some of the other officers and my platoon sergeant, who'd been in the 1721st Lancers in the First War, my platoon sergeant, Tex Rickard, now dead, but survived the war, survived two wars. And in May, due to the fact that three or four of our company officers had had a slight altercation with our own immediate command, when the order came from divisional headquarters that 100 RASC had got to go on a working party to Singapore and leave Changi Camp, it was no coincidence that the four of us, Taylor, Benzie, Janice and Adams, were included in the draft. And they were attached to a draft from 53 Brigade headquarters, from 53 Infantry Brigade, I should say. And we came under the command, as prisoners, of Brigadier Duke, the Brigadier of 53 Brigade. And we marched 16 miles down to Bukit Timah and wound up on the Royal Singapore Golf Club, where we moved into the quite heavily bombed and damaged wooden barracks of what had been headquarters Royal Air Force Far East. Well, we had arrived at this hutted camp, which had been RAF headquarters, and there were lots of holes in roofs and things like that, but the Japanese left us alone for a couple of three days, and we had the opportunity to scavenge the area looking for nails, and where there had been two damaged huts, we made one good hut out of two. The trouble was many of the nails had been burnt when these places had set on fire under bombing or shelling, and when you're hammering a nail that's been through fire, it bends, and there were lots of damaged fingers from the nails bending as you were hammering them.